monitoring and maintaining the safety and security of the working environment. Health and safety are an integral part of the work that you do to provide care for individuals. As with all aspects of care, your practice must be underpinned by legal and organisational requirements on equality, diversity, discrimination and rights. You must also provide active support which promotes the individual's rights, choices and well-being. That's fine, I hear you say, but can it be that simple? Well, as in care work, we may face issues that cause dilemmas. Listen to this case study. Joseph is a night shift worker in a nursing home for 20 residents. Joseph is a smoker. One other member of staff sleeps on the premises. Emma, a woman in her 90s, is also a smoker. At home, she always had a cigarette in bed before she went to sleep. When she came into the home, she pleaded with Joseph to let her smoke in bed. Joseph knew that there was a strict policy about smoking in bedrooms, but he knew that it settled Emma down for the night and stopped her wandering during the night looking for cigarettes. He made a point of sitting with her while she had her cigarette, and in fact, he had one as well, and they had a pleasant time chatting together before she went off to sleep. Joseph made sure that both cigarettes were safely disposed of. Do you think Joseph behaved in a safe manner? You may think on first reading that Joseph was indeed acting in a safe and caring manner. He was promoting an individual's choice to have a cigarette and acting safely by sitting with her, making sure she had finished her cigarette. Now look at it from a health and safety point of view. What if Joseph is suddenly called away on an emergency, leaving Emma with a lit cigarette? What if Emma starts to smoke when Joseph isn't there? There is legislation, the Smoking, Health and Social Care Scotland Act 2005, which makes it illegal to smoke in residential establishments, except in designated areas. There is a strict policy based on the legislation that must be followed by everyone using the building. Fire remains one of the greatest threats to safety in care establishments. In February 2004, a fire at the Rose Park home in Lanarkshire in Scotland caused the deaths of 14 residents. In retrospect, Joseph was not working in a safe manner and he was breaking the law. He should report the matter to his line manager and discuss some way of working through the problem, for example by encouraging Emma to have her last cigarette in the smoke room. The Scottish Government issued guidance in relation to the Smoking Health and Social Care Scotland Act 2005, Act for the NHS, local authorities and care service providers. You should familiarise yourself with this guidance, which is contained in Scottish Government 2005 Smoke Free Scotland, guidance on smoking policies for the NHS, local authorities and care service providers. Whilst the aim is for a smoke-free Scotland, the Act made some exemptions and allowances. There can be designated rooms for smoking in adult care homes, adult hospices, and residential psychiatric units. Whilst such rooms may be designated, proprietors are not obliged to do so. Working with and resolving conflicts between the individual's right to choose and the impact of their own health and safety will no doubt arise in your work with service users. Individuals may choose to smoke, drink too much alcohol, use illegal drugs, use prescribed medication in excess, eat food which damages their health, especially those who have diabetes, and eat foods which make them overweight. Individuals do, of course, have the right to express their needs and preferences, but in situations where there is a danger to themselves or others, you, as a care worker, should assist them to understand and take responsibility for promoting their own health and care and support them to assess and manage risk to their health and well-being. Offering support, providing advice and seeking support from outside agencies such as drugs or alcohol groups are some ways in which you can support people to promote their own health and care. Working with the care team and the individual to provide a care package to meet the needs of the individual is the most effective means of resolving these conflicts and dilemmas. We'll now look more closely at how we can achieve a safe working environment and continue to keep it safe. To do this, we're going to look at five main areas. Right of entry, keeping property and valuables secure, dealing with hazards, hazardous equipment and materials, spillages, body fluids, clinical waste, laundry, drugs and medicine. Aggressive and violent people. And reporting and recording health and safety issues. Right of entry. All individuals have the right to feel safe in the place where they live, whether this is a residential home, hospital, or their own home. To ensure that feeling of safety, you have to check people's right to enter, be in or around the premises in which you're working, and take appropriate actions to deal with people who do not have that right. Organisations should have procedures which apply to these, and workers should be aware of these and always follow any guidelines. In large organisations, such as hospitals, employees normally wear some form of easily identifiable uniforms and identity badges. The badge may also have a photograph and a built-in swipe system, which allows access to secure areas. Employees may also be given entry codes to secure doors, and many hospitals now have CCTV equipment and buzzer entry systems on some wards, for example, baby and children's wards. In care homes and day centres, workers normally do not wear uniforms, but may wear badges as proof of identity. Some work environments may have a reception area to which all visitors should report, and where they may be given a visitor's badge. If there is no formal practice, you should be aware of visitors on the premises and be vigilant. A member of senior staff should make staff aware if there is to be a visit from the utility companies such as gas, electricity or water, and workers from those agencies should carry identification. All workers who represent outside agencies such as health, social work, care commission inspectors, plumbers or electricians should be required to produce evidence of identity. What is the appropriate action to take if you encounter someone who does not have the right to be in or around the premises? Again, organisations should provide staff with guidelines. You should familiarise yourself with frequent visitors from external agencies. If you do not recognise a visitor, you should always be polite and ask if you can help them. If they are from an outside agency, ask for proof of identity and escort them to a senior member of staff or the reception area. Do not direct them to an area of the building. Always take them. You're advised never to tackle an intruder whom you encounter on the premises. Call for assistance from other staff or the police if required. If a visitor asks to see someone, always check with the individual first to find out if they wish to receive the visitor. This is very important, as people have the right to choose whether or not to receive a visitor. If the person does refuse to see someone, then the worker should inform the visitor in an assertive manner that the person does not wish to see them, rather than falling into the trap of telling white lies such as, "Oh, they're sleeping." You should be aware that this might be upsetting for the visitor. However, you should advise the visitor that if the individual changes their mind, you'll contact them. You might take a contact telephone number for the visitor, but you should not take any messages from them, as this may upset the person in your care. This may be a very difficult area for you to deal with, especially if relatives are insistent. You should seek advice from a senior member of staff, especially if the individual is very vulnerable, for example, has dementia, learning difficulties, communication difficulties, is very ill, or is a child. There should be some mention of acceptable visitors in an individual's care plan in these circumstances. Care in the community now means that more individuals live in their own home, and this situation demands special consideration of who has right of entry. Many people who live on their own are vulnerable and may need individual support from workers. The police provide information on how to deal with bogus callers or telephone calls. You're advised to provide individuals with the relevant information about this, as well as provide short, bullet-pointed lists at the front door and at the phone to remind them. Several local authorities have Safe as Houses and Care and Repair schemes, which provide protection for vulnerable people who live alone. The Home Watch, known as Neighbourhood Watch in Britain scheme, first introduced from the USA to Millington, Cheshire in 1982, is now becoming popular in many areas and has a special remit in keeping an eye out for vulnerable people who live alone. It may, in some instances, be prudent to inform the local police that a vulnerable person is living alone in the area. People who live alone may be vulnerable to unwanted visitors, either relatives or friends. Of course, people do have choice and the right to admit anyone they wish into their own home, and these rights have to be respected. However, you should be aware that some visitors may prey on vulnerable people and workers should be vigilant. As you cannot be with the individual on a 24 hours a day basis, it is critical that you report immediately any sign of danger, harm or abuse of which you become aware. This may take many forms, including physical, emotional, sexual or financial. Keeping property and valuables secure. Most individuals have personal possessions which are precious to them, whether these items are valuable or not. To ensure that these items are kept safely, organisations should have some policies for recording and storing them, and you should be aware of these. Most organisations have a system whereby all items are recorded on admission or as required. This will normally be some type of book that must be signed by the individual, if possible, or relative, or at least one member of staff. More valuable items may be recorded separately and may require the signature of a senior member of staff. Valuables should be kept in locked area, and only designated staff should have access. It is not advisable to keep items of great value or large sums of money on the premises. Individuals should be given advice about how to deposit such valuables in a bank or other secure area. Dealing with hazards. A hazard is something with a potential to cause harm. A risk is the chance, high or low, that someone will be harmed by that hazard. As you will no doubt anticipate, the number of potential hazards in the working environment is numerous. As a worker, you have responsibilities in relation to hazards. You will need to be aware of potential hazards. You will need to deal with hazards, if appropriate, by taking individual action. You need to report hazards that you are unable to deal with to your manager, so that they become an organisational responsibility. Hazards come in many shapes and forms. We'll examine three main sources of hazards: equipment, hazardous materials, chemicals, body fluids, laundry, drugs, and aggressive and violent people. Equipment. Equipment comes in all shapes and sizes, from the simplest to the most complex. This may range from high-tech hospital machines to lifting and moving equipment to a vacuum cleaner, kettle or washing bowl. All equipment is designed to assist the user to carry out the job in a safer manner, both to themselves and to the people they are assisting. Duties apply to the use of equipment in three areas: safe use of equipment, care of equipment, and reporting of unsafe equipment. Employers have a duty, in law, to provide safe equipment. You, as a worker, have a duty in law to use that equipment safely. You should receive training in the use of all specialist equipment, and you should always follow the guidelines given to you. If you have any doubts about the safety of any equipment you're asked to use, even if you're unsure, you should stop using the equipment immediately and report it to the appropriate person. Often workers, especially those who are new or unqualified, feel uncertain about reporting unsafe equipment to their superiors in case they are labelled as fussy or troublemakers. If in doubt, you should always err on the side of caution and report anything, no matter how small, to a superior. After all, your own and others' safety could be at risk. Here's an example. Nathabo was recently employed as a care assistant in a nursing home for older adults, many of whom require assistance with their washing. In her first week, she was asked to clean the plastic bowls used for bed-bathing individuals. No one had shown her how to carry out this task. The only instructions she was given were to make sure she made a thorough job of it. Keen to make a good impression, Nathabo took all the bowls to the designated washing area. She washed them in hot soapy water and disinfectant, and to give them an extra good clean, scrubbed them with abrasive pads she found in a box in a cupboard under the sink. Satisfied she'd done a good job, she tried them with paper towels and stacked them neatly on top of each other and put them away in the cupboard. No one had provided Nathabo with the proper training, and so she was unable to carry out the task in the manner that took care of the washing bowls. The correct way to clean these bowls was to wash them with hot soapy water and disinfectant, but not use any abrasive material on them, as this roughens the surface and provides a perfect place for microorganisms, or germs, to stick to and multiply. Also, the bowls needed to be thoroughly dried with disposable towels and not stacked inside each other, but stored upside down in a pyramid to allow air to circulate through them. Taking care of equipment is also an important part of health and safety. People can be careless with equipment, sometimes deliberately and sometimes because they have not been given the correct instruction on the proper care procedures. Hazardous materials. The Control of Substances Hazardous to Health Regulations 1999, usually referred to as COSH, require employers to prevent or control exposure to hazardous substances such as chemicals, dust, fumes, and microorganisms. Employers are required to protect everyone who is present in the working environment. For the most up-to-date information about COSH, you should visit the HSE, Health and Safety Executive, website. In a care environment, hazardous substances fall into two main categories: cleaning materials and related products, and clinical waste. All workers should receive training in the risks and precautions to be taken when working with hazardous substances. There should be a COSH file which clearly outlines the type of substance kept in the workplace, where and how they are stored, the type of labels on the containers, the effect of the substances, and how to deal with an emergency involving any of the substances. In care settings, the most common types of material are cleaning materials, disinfectants, bleaches, and pesticides. None of these substances should be used without workers receiving clear guidelines for their use. For example, some commonly used on their own can become extremely dangerous when mixed or used together. A good example of this is that some types of toilet cleaner and bleach mixed together may give off chlorine gas. All types of cleaning materials and related products should be stored in the correct manner, in a safe place, in containers which have safety lids and caps, and should be correctly labelled. It's important that products are always kept in their own containers and labels are not changed. If you're supporting an individual in their own home, it's important that you help them store their cleaning materials safely. Always check that cleaners and so on have not been decanted into other containers such as lemonade bottles or cartons, as in the past there have been deaths caused by people mistaking fluids or bleach for a drink. Dealing with spillages. Spillages fall into two main categories: chemical-based products and body fluids. All workers should receive training on how to deal with spillages of chemical-based products. These products may come in many forms: liquid, powder, cream, aerosol, spray. Each container should be clearly marked with a hazard symbol. New international symbols are being introduced. You should check the HSE website for information about these. The most common warning signs are corrosive, harmful, irritant, toxic, and very toxic. Any spillages of these products which have a hazard symbol should be treated with care. You should check with the COSH file or a senior member of staff if you need assistance to find out what precaution you should take to deal with a spillage, and you should follow any guidelines given. This may involve the use of protective clothing and gloves, aprons, or even goggles. If you are in any doubt, always ask for assistance. And if you have any concerns about the storage methods, use, or types of materials kept in your working environment, then you should report this immediately to your line manager, who will then assume responsibility for dealing with the problem. Body fluids. Care must be taken when cleaning up body fluids. These fluids include blood, semen, vaginal secretions, sputum, fluids from the lung, brain and other areas, tissue, organs, and saliva in dental procedures. It also includes any other fluid, such as urine, faeces, nasal secretion, and vomit. Some general rules apply to the cleaning up of body fluids. 1. Restrict access to the area. 2. Wear gloves to protect your hands. Avoid tearing your gloves on equipment or sharp objects. Torn gloves should be replaced immediately. 3. Use additional personal protection as needed, for example, leak-proof apron and/or eye protection. 4. Use disposable towels to soak up most of the fluid. 5. Clean with appropriate disinfectant solution, which is 10 parts water to 1 part bleach. Bleach will kill both the HIV and hepatitis B virus. After cleaning, promptly disinfect mops and other cleaning equipment, otherwise you might spread the viruses to other areas. And 6. Put all the contaminated towels and waste in appropriate, sealed, labelled, leak-proof containers. Clinical waste. All waste generated in a care setting that has been in contact with blood or other body fluids is classed as clinical waste and has the potential to harm. Here is a very useful list from the booklet Health and Safety in Care Homes 2001, produced by the Health and Safety Executive. While you might think this type of list would be more appropriate to healthcare workers, such as nurses, it might surprise you how many care workers in any care setting now have to deal with many of the items on this list. The list is divided into waste groups and then types of clinical waste. Group A. Identifiable human tissue. Blood, soiled surgical dressings, swabs, and other similar soiled waste. Other waste materials, for example from infectious disease cases, excluding any in groups B to E. Group B. Discarded syringe needles, cartridges, broken glass or other contaminated disposable sharp objects or items. Group C. Microbiological cultures and potentially infected waste from pathology departments and other clinical or research laboratories. Group D. Drugs or other pharmaceutical products. And Group E, items used to dispose of urine, faeces, and other bodily secretions or excretions that do not fall into Group A. This includes the use of disposable bedpans or bedpan liners, incontinence pads, sanitary towels, tampons, stoma bags, urine containers, and laundry. Disposal of waste. The disposal of waste is a crucial part of the care process, as it is the most direct means by which infection can be passed on to individuals and workers. Infections are dangerous to everyone, but in particular to those individuals who are in poor health, or are old, or young, and therefore more vulnerable to infection. You're probably aware of the terms MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, and C. diff, Clostridium difficile, that have been in the news recently. Individuals have become extremely ill from these, and in some cases have died. For example, the Healthcare Commission reported in 2006 that in two outbreaks of C. difficile at Stoke Mandeville Hospital, 33 people died and 334 patients were infected. Reducing the spread of infection requires the use of standard infection control procedures, which will be described later on. All staff should receive the appropriate training in the disposal of waste and be clear about what is classified as clinical waste and what constitutes domestic waste. The Hazardous Waste Regulations 2005 place a duty on waste producers in health and care settings to segregate hazardous and non-hazardous waste at source. Segregation is based on a colour-coded scheme linked to disposal. Yellow, infectious, incineration. Orange, infectious, alternative treatment. Purple, cytotoxic, cytostatic, includes a range of dangerous drugs. And yellow with a black stripe, offensive, hygiene. Laundry, often referred to as linen, has also been given careful consideration in relation to its disposal. When working with any type of linen, it is advisable to wear gloves and aprons. Used linen refers to the bulk of linen which is used on a daily basis but is not soiled. This would include sheets, pillowcases, towels, and items of clothing. Soiled linen is linen that has been contaminated with blood or other body fluids, for example, urine, semen, sputum, or faeces. Your organisation should have clear guidelines about how this type of linen should be dealt with. Normally, there will be specific types of clearly marked plastic bags for this, and these bags will be dealt with separately in the laundry. Infected linen is linen which has been in contact with infectious conditions, such as hepatitis, MRSA, C. difficile, HIV, pulmonary tuberculosis, and so on. Again, this linen must be dealt with carefully. Guidelines should be clearly given to workers who have to deal with this. Gloves and aprons are essential, and linen should be placed in special, clearly marked bags, which are specially designed to dissolve when washed at high temperature washes of 95 degrees centigrade or above. Drugs and medicine. Drugs and medicine require particular attention, as they are dangerous if misused. All should be stored in a safe place, clearly labelled, and only authorised workers who have been fully trained should have access to them and be allowed to administer them to individuals. Some drugs will require specific storage, for example in specific temperatures, and a small number of drugs, such as some creams and powders, may require particular methods of handling. In cases where workers are supporting individuals in their own homes, due caution to ensure safe storage should be adhered to and strict adherence to the prescription directions should be followed. Again, only qualified, trained staff should administer drugs to individuals in their own home. Advice should always be sought from the medical professionals, GPs or pharmacists, if there is any doubt. All drugs and medicine are classed as clinical waste, and as such are governed by rules of disposal. Never flush unused drugs down the toilet or place them in a refuse bin. Workplaces which use large amounts of drugs, such as hospitals, clinics and care homes, should have guidelines for these procedures, and these should be strictly adhered to. If working in an individual's home, it is advisable that all unused medicines should be returned to the nearest pharmacist. Aggressive and violent people. Violence towards workers is today an all too common occurrence. Unison Scotland obtained data under a Freedom of Information request which showed 25,046 incidents of violence against staff were recorded in 2008 and 2009. Any act of violence on a member of staff going about their business of providing vital public services is completely unacceptable. To have £25,000 a year is shocking. So said Dave Watson from Unison Scotland. It is now recognised that aggression and violence to workers are a source of injury and distress. And violent incidents may include verbal abuse, threatening behaviour or assault. What must be considered is not only workers but service users, key people and others may also be at risk. It is therefore vital that the care environment is made as safe as possible for everyone who uses the setting, and that there should not be a tacit acceptance that aggression and violence are unavoidable occupational hazards. Protection of staff and service users falls under the remit of both the Health and Safety at Work Act 1974 and the Management of Health and Safety at Work Regulations 1999. Organisations should have a policy relating to aggression and violence. As with all hazards in the workplace, a risk assessment should be carried out by the organisation to establish if there is a problem with aggression and violence. Methods of reducing these risks should be sought, clear guidelines given for areas of responsibility, and a procedure for supporting people who have been assaulted or who have experienced verbal abuse should be in place. All workers should receive training and information about potentially violent situations within the organisation and be kept up to date with relevant information about individuals. Lone workers should be alert to potential violence or aggression. If there is any concern about the likelihood of this arising, you should not work alone. You should always have a partner with you on visits or extra staff on night duty in a care establishment. You should not be put at risk from violent individuals, and it may be that alternative or additional support should be provided by the managers of the care team. Violence or the threat of violence may have serious repercussions on the stress levels of workers, service users, key people and others. If you feel that you or others have been affected in this way, it is important that you report the incident and its effects to your line manager. Recording and reporting health and safety issues. It's essential that all health and safety issues are both reported and recorded. It is your duty to report anything in the workplace which you think is a potential hazard to yourself or to others, no matter how trivial the hazard may seem. As you will see in a later section, there are particular procedures for reporting incidents and accidents under the Reporting of Injuries, Disease and Dangerous Occurrences Regulations, often referred to as RIDOR. In Activity 6, the most important consideration is that Verinda should not be treated any differently from others in the unit. In the next section, we'll consider the use of standard infection control procedures that should be used in all care environments to protect both individuals and workers alike. Verinda, however, does present a health risk to workers and others in the unit, and you would have to inform him of this. And further, that his information would have to be passed to an appropriate senior member of staff, for example, Verinda's key worker. But with the reassurance that the information would not be passed on to all staff members or others living in the unit. Reporting of health and safety issues should always be taken seriously, and organisations should have procedures for this. Normally, you should report your findings to an appropriate member of senior staff. It is simply not enough to complain to a fellow worker that you are fed up because the hoist to assist individuals into the bath is not working. Issues such as this should be brought to the attention of an appropriate member of the senior staff, who should record in writing all such issues. If issues are not dealt with to your satisfaction, you should report the issue again, and if necessary, take the matter to a more senior member of staff or to your union representative. Recording health and safety information is governed by the same legislation and organisational policies that apply to all information, including the Data Protection Act.